And then I'll like send like just a text message, just a gentle nudge to see like, you're okay, you remember we're meeting up, right? We, for a long time, have tried to grasp and keep time. And clocks in particular bring this sense of order, this sense of almost conformity in society, because we're all like, you know, supposed to be tracking on the same time. The scientist Newton once like famously declared, and he was building on the words of Galileo, that the whole universe is like a giant clock. You've heard that image before, right? That the universe is following mathematical laws, and it's very orderly, and it's almost kind of mechanical. And for Newton, he kind of just thought like time just is, you know, steadily ticking by. And all of us are experiencing the same sense of time. So we have the past, we have the future, and we are all in now. And this like idea of the clock really captured the imagination of 18th century people. And so they started, I mean, clocks had been around before them, but from the 18th century onwards, clocks became a really big thing, and particularly like keeping hours and then minutes and more precision. So they're like, you know, we need timetables. We now have trains. So we need timetables so we can know exactly like the time the train will come, because they'll be on time. We need to know like when to work. So when do we start? When do we clock off? And maybe from the employer's perspective, they wanted to make sure that the hours that people are working, they're working really hard. We need to work out the time zone. So if I want to send a telegraph to someone, like I know like at what time they're going to be able to receive it. And it felt like time was really precise, like something we could have control over, something like a resource that we could allocate, and we could like manage our time and say, I'm going to use my time this way. And even today, I feel like time feels like this really precious resource that we have. But when we look at the scriptures, God doesn't seem to be following the same sense of clocks that we might have. And God seems to go in all different directions. We have been in Isaiah for a long time. And one of the things you might have noticed is that Isaiah gives all these visions of things that are going to happen. But it's really hard to pin down when. Like, is this in Isaiah's time? Is it 100 years into the future? Is it more than 100 years? And Isaiah speaks about this day. He calls it the day of Yahweh. He's not the only one. In fact, most of the prophets after the exile start to speak about this day of Yahweh that's going to come. Malachi, I don't know how often you look at Malachi, but Malachi is the last book in the Old Testament. And in the last chapter of Malachi, he speaks about the day of Yahweh coming, and it's going to burn everything up like a big furnace. Everything that is wrong is going to be burned up. And then, which is kind of terrifying, he switches in verse 2 and he says this: "But for you who revere my name, the sun of righteousness shall rise with healing in its wings. You should go out leaping like calves from the stall." A day will dawn. A time will come when God will come, and it will be a great but also kind of terrible day. But before that day comes, Malachi says, God will raise up a prophet, the prophet Elijah. And this prophet will prepare people's hearts towards one another and towards God. And this prophet will prepare the way for this day. After these words are given, the sun rises, the sun sets, days pass, seasons passes, different kings and emperors that reign, and then they die and are buried. Sacrifices are made in the temple, festivals are celebrated, buildings go up, buildings collapse. People are born. If they're fortunate, they live a long life, and then they too are buried. There are wars and times of conquest. There's brief snatches of peace. Towns expand, towns shrink. It all moves so slowly, it seems very predictable. At the beginning of the 20th century, scientists believed they knew everything about physics, like that we'd sorted it all out, and maybe all we needed to work on was like more precise measurements. And then in 1905, this relatively unknown person, you might have heard of him though, Albert Einstein, just 26 years old, produces 4 groundbreaking papers. Now, he's living in the land of clocks. He's living in Switzerland. And he has a job, but it doesn't seem to require a lot of effort, because in this year he writes his 4 groundbreaking papers and he completes his PhD. But in this year, these papers challenge kind of everything anyone knows about light and time and space. And so people look back at 1905 and they call it a miracle year. And one of the things he suggests is that time runs at different speeds, that depending on where you're moving and where you are, that time is relative, it's not absolute. And then almost 10 years later, he'll build on this theory and he'll start to think about gravity. And he'll suggest that there's this relationship between gravity and light and space and time, that they collide in one another, that they're affected by one another, that time actually might speed up or slow down depending on its relationship with gravity, that light might actually bend towards gravity. And that language of time slowing down or speeding up, we sometimes use that too to speak about time, don't we? Like kids at Christmas feel like time moves so slowly. Like, you know, when you're waiting and you wake up really, really early on Christmas Day and you're like, oh, my parents are still asleep, and you're like waiting for time to move on to like 6 o'clock, and then that's acceptable time for now, parents to wake up and open presents. And kids often speak about like being bored. Like, it's like they have so much time on their hands. They're like, I don't know what to do with all this time. Whereas adults, we often have the opposite experience, right? Like, Christmas is this frantic, hectic time that passes in a blur and we're like, what just happened? And even our own lives, you know, the older you get seems to go faster and faster. It's like, I don't have enough time to do everything that I want to do. We also speak about grief, you know, the experience of grief sometimes as this time where things slow down. Many, many years later, Einstein was writing a letter to the Queen of Belgium whose husband had died, and he writes this response to comfort her. He says, "And yet as always, the springtime sun brings forth new life, and we may rejoice because of this new life and contribute to its unfolding. A Mozart remains as beautiful and tender as he always and always will be. There is, after all, something eternal that lies behind, that beyond the hand of fate and of all human delusions." Our lives are somehow caught up in the eternal, he says. Now, what he means by this is hard to grasp, because it seems that Einstein kind of believed that time ultimately is an illusion. But Christians also speak of this hope too, don't we? That of eternity, that something lies beyond the time of clocks. When we look at how God speaks about time in the Bible, like, it's all over the place. Like, God speaks about the kingdom of God being near, but not yet. It's here, but not here. We speak about, like, 1,000 years is like a day in the eyes of God. It's like past and future all mingled together. There's a fluidity about how God speaks about time. And so Christians have tried to grapple with, like, time and its relationship to God. And so for a long time, a lot of Christians have spoken about God being timeless. You might have heard this before, that, like, God kind of stands outside of time, is a temporal, kind of can see all of time, all of past, present, future, all at once. And that's kind of the common way that we picture God. Although there have been a growing number of Christian theologians and scientists, particularly probably from the last 100 years, who have challenged that a little bit and have suggested that maybe God has chosen to be temporal, has chosen to be in time with us. And one of, I guess, the weaknesses about the atemporal position is it makes God feel really detached from everything, if God's just kind of looking at everything all at once. And so some theologians have said maybe God is with us in time, and maybe there's an openness to the future, that not everything is set yet. Theologians and scientists still are trying to work out what time is and what does it mean to speak about eternity. Christians trust that there is eternity, but what that looks like, is it a deeper sense of time? Is it time outside of time? Like, it's hard to actually grasp, but we trust in the sense that there is something beyond the time of clocks. Scientists today are still grappling with Einstein's ideas, and a lot of Einstein's ideas led to, you know, like quantum physics, which is very trippy, and black holes, which actually, even though Einstein started these ideas, he actually really resisted a lot of the direction that science ended up going. Like, it challenged him in a lot of ways as well. And quantum physics, I guess, is very trippy because it speaks more about the randomness of things. It's not as orderly as Einstein might have wished it was. And so today, scientists are still trying to, like, piece together, like, how does time relate to space and light, and where are we in the universe? And this, like, I try to get into it, and then I was like, this is beyond my little brain to grasp. It's a lot of mathematics as well, which also made me drift off. But it's really fascinating, isn't it? Like, at the end of the day, what looking at time reminds us of is that the universe is weird. And this says something about who God is, that God is kind of weird and mysterious, and yet we're invited to look and wonder. We're invited to look and wonder. You know, the gospel writer Luke was looking and wondering at Jesus. And as he looks and wonders at Jesus, he starts trying to set an orderly account, he says, of Jesus' life, which is pretty hard to do when talking about Jesus. And so he narrows in on a particular time and place. We describe it today as the first century AD, but Luke describes it like this, chapter 1, verse 5. In the time of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah. Zechariah has lived a long time, but he and his wife Elizabeth carry this grief. They haven't been able to have children. There's no springtime sun. Maybe there's moments when Elizabeth thought, am I pregnant? Maybe she started to count the days, but then no. And all around them in their neighborhoods, they see families expanding, babies being born, and babies growing up, and now they're adults, and now they're having their own families. But things kind of remain the same for Elizabeth and Zechariah. Zechariah, we are told, is a faithful priest, and one of the roles of the priest is actually to help people keep time, kind of to point people back to God. So throughout their weeks, there's this rhythm that helps them to turn back to God, to worship God. And then one day, it seems by chance, his division is selected to serve in the temple, and then he himself is chosen to serve in the temple. Now, this is a great honor. Zechariah is excited to do this. I mean, he has looked at this temple his whole life, and over the course of his lifetime, this temple has had extensive renovations and extensions happening, so it's becoming this grander and grander place. He steps into the temple, and it's almost like time slows down. He steps into darkness, and it takes a moment for his eyes to adjust. And then slowly he sees the candlelight, the smoke hanging in the air, the smell of incense and oil. His job is to attend to the altar of incense. This is what God had instructed the people. Burn the incense night and day. Keep time this way. And so they do. And God says, I will meet you in this place. So as Zechariah is burning incense, he prays. He prays about the grief that he and Elizabeth have. He prays about all the things that's wrong in the world. He prays for the impossible, for the springtime sun to come. And then it's like time jolts. There before him at the right-hand side of the altar of incense stands an angel. He almost drops the things he's holding. His heart is beating fast, but at the same time, it's almost like time has stopped. And this dazzling figure says to him, God has heard your prayers. You're going to have a son. Name him John, and he's going to be like the prophet Elijah. In the same spirit and power of Elijah, your son will prepare the people's hearts to God, will lean them back to one another. Your son is going to prepare the way for the Lord to come. And Zechariah kind of queries this, and he's like, how can you be sure? And so the angel says this, verse 19, I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I've been sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. But now, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time, you will become mute, unable to speak until the day these things occur. You will not be able to utter a word until these things happen. Zechariah eventually steps back out of the temple and all these worshippers kind of bombard him, like, where are you? Why did you take so long? Why can't you speak? And he kind of like rushes through them and gets on with his job. He has a few more days serving, but finally his service is done. He returns back home to Elizabeth and some time passes. And then Elizabeth begins to hold her breath, begins to count the days. Could it be possible? Yes, she's pregnant. And at first, they kind of keep this news between themselves. They stay secluded for as long as possible. And then I think Elizabeth must finally start to be able to breathe again. And she says, in these days, God has blessed me. In 1922, a group of scientists and photographers descend on this empty beach about 300 kilometres south of Broome. It's a pretty remote area, there's no roads, but they want to bring a giant telescope in. And so to get this telescope in, they have to get the Navy involved. So the Navy comes with these boats and they carry all their equipment in, but can only, you know, get to the edge of the water. And so then local Aboriginal people come and they help and they get this like team of donkeys and the wagons and they load all this equipment on. It takes them about 3 days to set up this telescope. This telescope looks kind of strange in this landscape. It's described as like this giant cannon, except it's pointing towards the sky. And this group of scientists and photographers gather. They say, now the time has come. We've been watching and waiting for this time. Now we're finally going to prove, there has been one attempt before, but now we're finally going to prove in Australia that Einstein's theories are correct. And so they've been waiting and planning for this time when there will be a total solar eclipse. And as it happens, as the sun becomes this black circle, the stars kind of near the sun become visible. And so these photographers take these photos and then they process these photos and they capture about 140 stars and then they start measuring the precision of the light and where it goes. And they're like, it's true. The star's light, you can actually see, is bending towards the sun by the gravitational field of the sun. They say, this is wondrous. How marvelous. This mystery of time is slowly unraveling before us. One of the gifts I think that scientists bring is the gift of curiosity, that it's a good thing to be curious, to look and to wonder. Zechariah has had months to be curious and to think back to what happened in the temple. And finally, one morning, he can hear the sound of a baby crying. The midwives report, all's healthy, everything's okay, and he finds himself crying too. And he can speak. And having not been able to speak for a long time, having to contemplate and to be curious and to think about God, his first words are this song of praise to God, as he praises God for the way God has been at work in history, for the prophets long ago, how they were pointing to this day. He praises God for the mystery of who God is kind of unraveling before him. And he says this, verse 76, "A new child will be called the prophet of the Most High. For you will go before the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation to his people by the forgiveness of their sins. By the tender mercy of our God, the dawn from on high will break upon us, to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace." There's this baby in his arms and it is groundbreaking. A miracle year indeed. How many mornings has Zechariah seen, but none like this? The baby like squints, trying to get adjust to this world that's full of so much light. This is a baby who will grow up to be a man who will call people to turn to God in the desert and then plunge them into the water. This is a man who will stand by Jesus in the blazing sun and see the Spirit of God descend on him like a dove. This time of sleepless nights will pass a blur and things will mostly settle back down to some sense of normality for Zechariah. But Zechariah will never forget this morning when he held his child in his arms and he felt the light hit his face. He sings, God's glory is like the dawn, breaking up the darkness. God is here with us, pulling us into the way of peace. The day of the Lord is here. It's happening. is still to happen. The season of Advent is a time that reminds us that time doesn't work in a linear way. God doesn't work in a linear way. We are linked to the past and we look to the future. And the early church got this. They would sing songs linking themselves to the past, telling the story of Jesus, the story of Zechariah, and also looking towards the future, longing for the time when Jesus will come again. And so they'd chant, mostly in Latin, they'd chant this. O morning star of righteousness, your life shines brightly in the night. Dispel our shadows and bring us light, illumine our darkness. Another John, a friend of Jesus, would describe or give the title of Jesus of being the morning star, which is the first star you see just before dawn. In the last book of our Bibles, in Revelation, in the last chapter, you have Jesus speaking and he says, I am coming soon. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the bright morning star. Keep watch. And so the early church would chant this song in the lead up to Christmas, and then eventually it was translated from Latin into other languages and kind of changed a little bit. So today we sing, come, come, O day spring, come and cheer, O son of justice, now draw near. Day spring is another word for dawn, breaking. Maybe you feel like your head has a clock ticking inside it. Maybe particularly at this time of the year when it's like this frantic time of the year, like I've got to see everybody before the end of the year. I've got to like make sure I get all the presents and say all the thank yous that I need to and catch up with all the relatives, and it can feel very frantic. This time of the year is often also called the happiest time of the year, and that can be jarring if you're not feeling particularly happy and you see all these photos, particularly online, of everyone meeting up with their loved ones. And so this time of the year can also bring up grief for us, particularly if there's those we love who are no longer with us. It can illuminate our loneliness. And yet Advent invites us to a different way of looking at time, that the clock in our head is not the main thing. Advent invites us actually just to be with God, and to look up at the stars, to look at a sunset or a sunrise, to hold a baby in your arms and to just be. God says, look and wonder, be curious and see what is unfolding before you. I am at work in this world. So I want to give us a moment now just to be still, to be with God for a moment, and then I'm going to lead us in a prayer.